Welcome to the Black Friday special shoppers edition of Voices. I'm Marge May, your host. Wherever you shop in the US, you encounter a daunting array of products made in China. For example, according to recent statistics, 80% of toys and 92% of shoes sold in the US are made in China. Today we speak to Gregory Fay, Program Coordinator for China Labor Watch. He will be discussing the situation for workers in factories in the city of Shenzhen in the province of Guangdong in China. Before joining China Labor Watch, or CLW, early in 2009, Greg Fay completed a research project at Xinjiang Normal University as a U.S. Fulbright Scholar. A graduate of Brown University with a degree in East Asian Studies, Greg also worked as an English teacher in Shenzhen, and has been trained in Chinese language and Chinese studies at Heilongjiang University, Indiana University, Duke University in Beijing, and the University of Hawaii at Manoa. The fundamental beliefs that guide the work of CLW are these: that social and economic justice is essential to universal lasting peace. Freedom of expression and association are essential to sustainable progress. Poverty anywhere constitutes a threat to prosperity everywhere. All workers have a right to be represented by the organization of their choosing. Workers are entitled to dignity, respect, and a living wage. Gregory Fay, Program Director for China Labor Watch, welcome to WERU.
Thank you. It's very nice to be here.
Could you give us a brief history of China Labor Watch and talk about its mission?
Well, China Labor Watch was founded by Chinese labor activist Li Chang in the year 2000. Our organization is based in New York, and we also have an office in Shenzhen, which administers our programs in China. CLW's mission is to defend the rights of Chinese workers, and this work is divided into three areas. First, international education. Second, direct service. And third, corporate collaboration. So first, through press releases, updates of labor news on our website, in-depth labor reports, and communications with media and other labor and human rights organizations, CLW presents the international community with an accurate picture of the labor situation in China. We publish factory investigations that respond to the interests of international partners and the latest developments in the labor movement. Second, CLW focuses on worker education and offers monthly training sessions to labor activists in Shenzhen. Our Shenzhen office also provides free legal consulting, both in person and via a free hotline. Third, by maintaining close relationships with many of the companies that source from Chinese factories, CLW encourages a business framework in China that brings workers' rights to the fore of international discourse. CLW directly engages factories via their international purchasers and has instituted in-factory training, complaint mechanism improvement plans, and factory monitoring.
Talk about some of the activities. You just really gave us a very good synopsis of the kinds of things that you do. What about some of your programs, say, working directly with Chinese workers?
Well, one of the programs we have that works directly with Chinese workers is a worker activist training program. Every month in our office in Shenzhen, CLW offers a free legal training session to workers to explain both how to implement activist work and also to explain the legal framework better to workers. Last year, there was a new labor contract law that was passed in China, and a number of workers are unclear about the contents of this law. So one of the main goals CLW has currently is to provide resources to workers who are interested in understanding the specifics of that law and how to use that law to address specific labor disputes or specific labor violations that they encounter.
You mentioned Shenzhen. Can you tell us about that area in China?
Absolutely. Shenzhen is just across the strait from Hong Kong. It's literally a one-hour bus ride from Hong Kong. It's on the same subway line as Hong Kong. And Shenzhen and Hong Kong are in the region of China that is called the Pearl River Delta. It's a region with a huge number of factories in really every industry, clothing, toy, electronics. They're all there. And Shenzhen itself is a special economic zone, which means that when China first began its reform period, when it was opening up to investment, there were special policies for investors coming to Shenzhen that made investment there more attractive. So before it was designated as a special economic zone, it was actually a small fishing village. And since then, it has grown extremely quickly, attracting migrant workers from across the country. So it's actually a very unique city in that it's filled with Chinese people from across this huge nation. And it's full of factories, and it's full of workers in those factories.
Any idea of numbers? How many people have migrated there to work in the factories?
I think that the number of people in Shenzhen is probably upwards of over a dozen million people. A large proportion of that is migrant workers. I know that it's probably also very difficult to track the number of workers there because, for example, every year at Spring Festival, a huge number of workers will go back to their home provinces and come back several weeks later. A lot of the workers who are working in these factories don't have local registration, which creates a number of difficulties for them in terms of education for their children, access to certain state benefits. So it is a difficult number to track.
I see. And you mentioned that you also work with some of the companies that use these this labor force. How do you work with them?
COW provides sort of consulting work for these companies where basically we provide access to our network of civil society organizations. Li Qiang, the executive director of COW, has contacts across a number of labor organizations that are operating in Shenzhen. And these organizations are really poised to help corporations who are looking to implement effective CR programs. So one program that we're seeing more of is
Excuse me, effective what programs?
corporate responsibility.
Okay, thank you.
One program that a lot of corporate responsibility programs are starting to implement is hotlines. And the use of a hotline is that workers and if they encounter a problem in a factory that factory management has not been able to deal with, one option corporations are starting to try to offer to those workers is for the worker to call a hotline that bypasses factory management and puts them in contact with the corporation itself, so the worker can explain to the corporation what problems they've encountered at the factory level. This kind of worker hotline program is something that civil society organizations in Shenzhen, organizations that are staffed and founded by labor activists in the area, they're uniquely set up to respond to those kind of calls, to answer the kind of questions workers will be asking. So COW is able to put corporations in contact with these kind of programs, with these kind of organizations.
Okay, and I'd like to remind our listeners that we are speaking with Greg Fay, Program Coordinator for China Labor Watch. What kinds of labor laws are there in China to protect workers, and are these laws enforced?
So again, last year, January 1st, 2008, the labor contract law was ratified in China. And this law has very important implications for workers. Basically, what it targets is the labor contracts that all workers are legally required to sign when they begin working at a factory. But through that, this law legislates a number of other areas of labor. It sets wages and working, or it sets working hours, it sets social security, it has legislation that covers unions, that covers quitting and severance packages. So according to that law, one of the most important changes that we've seen is the number of contracts signed by workers when they begin working at a factory has increased very much. That's not to say necessarily that all of the content of these labor contracts is necessarily being enforced. However, as a direct result of the law being passed last year, currently labor contracts are basically being signed by most workers, and most workers receive a copy of their contract. As for wages are set, the minimum wages are set locally. So different cities, different provinces all have different minimum wages. And as a result of that being locally legislated, we've seen a lot of factories moving, especially since the economic crisis, to areas where the local minimum wages are lower. Working hours and overtime are nationally legislated. So, working hours should be 40 hours per week. Overtime should be 9 hours per week maximum. That is a law that is very rarely enforced. 9 hours per week is something that no industry achieves in terms of overtime. Overtime costs or overtime wages, on the other hand, are something that, again, that's nationally legislated and often is more likely to be enforced. For weekday overtime, workers are supposed to get 1.5 times their normal wages. For weekend overtimes, they're supposed to get 2 times normal wages. And for holiday overtime, they're supposed to get 3 times normal wages. That's something that factories are fairly good about implementing. In terms of Social Security, again, that's something that was legislated by the new labor contract law. Social Security is something that factories are beginning to do better about, but it's something that's very expensive and something that is still not often enforced. So when I say Social Security, I'm talking about medical insurance and I'm talking about retirement insurance. And these are expenses that when Social Security is an option for workers, it's an expense that usually workers are going to be paying themselves. But in many industries, that's not even an option for workers. Finally, one interesting piece of legislation, and this is again part of last year's labor contract law, is a requirement that if workers are laid off, they need to be paid 1 month of severance. Severance equal to 1 month's salary for each year they've worked at a factory. And that is very important because it really raises the cost of conducting, for example, a layoff, which is something that we've been seeing a lot in the economic crisis. And in order to avoid having to pay that cost, one trend that we've seen in this economic situation is that factories will institute what we've come to call a disguised layoff, where factory management will coerce workers to sign resignation applications when they have no intention of resigning in order to conduct a layoff without having to pay severance to workers.
You are listening to Voices on WERU-FM. I'm Marge May, your host for the hour, and my guest is Gregory Fay, Program Coordinator for China Labor Watch. We are discussing the situation for workers in factories in the Shenzhen province of China. Tell us about how Chinese workers, factory workers, are compensated, just so our listeners have a sense of comparison. So it would be helpful to have some kind of average weekly or monthly wage and some kind of average work week in terms of hours in these factories.
Okay, so the average work week is difficult to calculate for a number of reasons, because factories are not required to report exactly what workers are working, especially considering that overtime is often extremely in excess of the legal limit on overtime, which is again 9 hours per week or 36 hours per month. But in general, what we've seen, especially since this economic crisis has begun, is workers working at least 2 hours to up to 4 or 5 hours of overtime every day. So if they're working 5 hours a day, that's the total of a 14-hour day, which factors out to about 150 hours of overtime a month. We've even seen workers working overtime through the night since this crisis has begun. And that may seem counterintuitive because you might think with orders down, factories would reduce overtime for each worker. However, in fact, what factories are trying to do is, increase output from every worker so that they can lower the total amount of workers they've hired, which explains also why unemployment is such a problem right now. In terms of how much workers are making, to give you a rough estimate, I would say about $150 each month. The minimum wage in every city is different again. It's usually about maybe between 60 and 70 cents US dollars for each hour that workers work. And if they're working, 14 hours a day, every day, working Saturday with perhaps 1 or 2 days off in a month, they'll be making between 130 and maybe 170 US dollars a month.
Now, is this a middle class wage in China, or is this a poverty level wage in China, $150 per month?
It is a very low wage in China. If these are workers who don't have a family to support and they are living in their dorm, the factory's dormitory, eating the factory's food, because a lot of these workers are young workers who have migrated to this factory rich region of Shenzhen in order to send money back and support their families in their home provinces. So these workers are not spending a lot of extra money on recreation. Perhaps they could put away in a month $100 to send home to their family, and that's if they're leading a very very meager existence. When you start talking about families who have to pay for education, who have to support housing for more than just themselves, for their spouse or their children, this wage starts to look a lot less full. There's definitely no more savings going on there. Workers may even experience difficulties funding the education of their children, the public education of their children.
Tell us about the situation with big clients of Chinese factories, such as Walmart and Disney. What is their influence on the compensation that workers get? What is their influence on the price of that they pay to purchase the goods from these factories?
Well, I'm happy that you mentioned Walmart because Walmart is, the largest retailer in the world. It's a huge corporation, and a corporation like Walmart, which has so many orders, has a tremendous amount of power in terms of the price that they pay. Because factories are very eager to get a Walmart order because Walmart orders are so huge and they're also likely to be long term. Walmart is not a company that's going away anytime soon. So one challenge that CLW has found in studying Walmart and studying Walmart's practices in China is that it's using these huge orders to leverage factories to sell goods at prices that are unsustainably low. And this puts pressure on other brands as well to pay less and sets a very dangerous industry precedent. Walmart, Disney, a lot of these major corporations are usually only one purchaser in a factory, and one of many other purchasers. Maybe they have 5 to 10, maybe 15% of orders in a factory. So often these brands, because they are just one of many in the factory, can sort of shake off the responsibility. They can say, you know, it's the other brands that are paying the low price, so we have to pay the low price. So in terms of taking responsibility, being just one brand in these factories sort of enables major corporations like Walmart or Disney to take an attitude towards the factory that, you know, what's going on in the factory is not their issue. Another trend that we're seeing in Walmart and Disney and in all of these major corporations that are operating in China, although they are developing more complete corporate responsibility codes, there's major problem with implementation of those codes. And one of the reasons for that is failure to identify labor violations in factories. And the reason for that is problems with this auditing process, with the factory auditing process. So we'll talk in terms of Walmart, because that's one that CLW does a lot of research on. Since April, Walmart has been working with third-party auditors.
This is April of 2009.
This is April of 2009.
Okay.
And these are international auditing corporations. They do audits, same companies do audits of other corporations as well. And the problems that I'm talking about are not specific to Walmart's auditors, they're specific to the whole industry. These auditors have a history of corruption. And by corruption, I mean bribery, and I mean fraudulent consulting services, where if a factory is about to go up for an audit, the factory management may get a call before the audit happens, and it is a call from someone who says they're with a consulting service. And what the consulting service can do is fix the audit results so that when this factory goes up for the audit, if they pay a certain amount of money for each violation, they can pass the audit in spite of having these violations.
So they pay the auditing company?
They pay, sometimes it's the auditing company, sometimes it's not the auditing company that is running this consulting service, this fraudulent consulting service. Sometimes it's someone connected to the auditing company. In any case, this corruption that is affecting the auditing companies is undermining the corporate responsibility efforts of any corporation, because they're getting information that tells them there are no labor violations in these factories, when in fact these factories are full of labor violations. So if they want to believe it, if they don't want to follow up on these audits, they're totally enabled to say, we have a supply chain here that is free from labor violations. And in reality, they have a supply chain that is full of labor violations, and they just have a very ineffective auditing system.
So, Chinese Labor Watch, CLW, you folks do some of your own auditing in the sense that you do profiles of some of these factories. Is that correct?
That is correct. They're not called audits because it's a different system than an auditor who announces to the factory or even goes unannounced to a factory. We do external investigations where we send our investigators basically outside a factory to go and speak with workers and conduct a statistically significant number of worker interviews, where our investigators will interview workers and talk to them about problems in the factory that the workers themselves have identified, and also talk about a number of common violations that CLW has identified as something that may be a problem in the factory. So by going outside the factory and talking with the workers themselves, CLW is able to bypass some of the potential corruption that is going on when these audits happen inside the factories themselves.
And how many of these profiles have you done?
We do many more of these profiles than we release publicly. We've released publicly since the organization was founded in the year 2000, upwards of 70 factory investigations. This year we've released probably half a dozen investigations. It's always a process of leveraging our investigations with all the different brands that are in a given factory to try to get our goal is to get the factory to improve. Our worst fear with these investigations is that as a result of the investigations, a company will pull out, will cancel its orders because that would make the process of improvement for our factory very, very difficult. So it's always a very complicated negotiation after we finish the investigation, and then we begin our conversations with all the different companies that are purchasing from that factory to try to put the pressure on these corporations in the right way to achieve the change in the factory that we're looking for.
I see. And do you contact the owners of the factory as well, or primarily the customers of the factory?
We contact both, but usually the pressure is not going to come from CLW telling the factory themselves, we know you have these violations. The pressure is going to come from CLW talking to the purchaser and the purchaser working out a plan with the factory as to how the factory is going to go about fixing the violations. Because ultimately, the factory already knows what's going on inside. So this transparency is most valuable, and this independent information is most valuable to these corporations who are sitting on audit data that is not necessarily true.
Very interesting. So, what would be some of the abuses that you find in these investigations? Just so people get a sense of what goes on in these factories and what the living conditions are like for these workers.
I think that it may be best for me to pick out an investigation specifically. One that I think is fairly interesting happened earlier this year at a Disney factory. It was at a stationery factory, and the reason CLW went and did an investigation of this factory is because in April, there was a worker who was, he was 17 years old at the time. He had been working in the factory since he was 15, and he was killed in when a machine, a paper crushing machine, malfunctioned. And so CLW went into this factory and did an investigation to see, what kind of conditions existed that this young boy was killed. In our investigation, we found that underage and child labor were widespread at the factory. And in the busy season, there were workers as young as 13 being hired. Child labor in China is a very, very serious allegation. It's not something that we find in a lot of factories. So that was something that raised a lot of flags for us that this is a factory where a lot of, very bad things are happening. In terms of labor contracts at that factory, a number of workers did not sign their a contract, which is again something that since the labor contract law was passed last year, is something the government takes very seriously. Wages at that factory were as low as only 113 a month for base salary, and overtime was mandatory, meaning that workers who didn't work overtime would face fines or be fired. Paid vacation at the factory was very limited, and maternity leave was denied. No training was provided to workers, and the factory had no handbook explaining occupational hazards. Many factory machines are old and outdated, and injuries at the factory were very common. And finally, dormitory conditions are poor, and normally 6 to 8, but up to 14 workers shared a single room in the busy season. So those are all conditions that we found at a single factory that was producing for Disney, Tesco, and a number of other brands.
Why should U.S. consumers care where the products they buy are made? Are products made in sweatshops really as cheap as buyers think?
Well, in terms of the cost to make these products, they're probably cheaper in terms of money than people think. These companies, as we mentioned before, can pressure factories to sell goods at such low prices. I've seen studies that have showed how doubling workers' wages could affect total retail price. and for a t-shirt that was selling at, I think, $40 if you doubled wages for workers, it would increase the cost of the t-shirt by maybe it was $1, or like 1% of the total retail price. So in terms of the cost of the labor and the cost of production of the products, yes, these goods are very cheap. In terms of the cost of producing goods in an unsustainable way, those costs are something that are very high. For one, there's environmental costs. What are going to be the results of pouring chemicals into the environment and producing these goods in a way that is really environmentally unsustainable? That's something that I think a lot of people are trying to figure out. When goods are produced in this unsustainable way, when workers are being abused, you tend to have more quality issues. This also relates back to the problem of corrupt auditors. You know, when auditors are turning their heads, maybe there will be lead in the toys, or maybe there will be other quality violations that people are not going to realize. And when a result of that is sometimes consumers will be injured by the products that are made in these unsustainable ways. And then I think that there's a less tangible sort of cost, which is a moral one. Families who are purchasing toys for their children probably don't want to be supporting an industry where children just a few years older are producing those toys in conditions that they would never ever imagine for their own children, for their own families. And I think that there's a growing concept that we're somehow morally responsible for the goods that we're purchasing, the goods that we're using in our everyday life. And consumers don't want to have goods that are made in a way that are really, you know, destroying human lives or at least enabling a lifestyle for workers that is not very healthy.
Greg, it is claimed that hundreds of billions of rural Chinese were aided by reforms in the 1980s that raised farm product prices. And nowadays, we hear from mainstream media, the gush, that the free market has lifted a similar number of millions of Chinese out of poverty. And my question to you is, into what?
I want to start by saying that these millions of migrant workers have not been lifted out of poverty. They're still working in poverty. The income gap between the richest and the poorest people in China is growing exponentially. And yes, it's true that there are many more employment opportunities than before this reform and opening period. However, distribution of the wealth that has been created in these 20 years is extremely uneven. So what is the experience of these millions of people? Poor working conditions is one. Again, you know, working 14 hours every day, sometimes working through the night. Since the economic crisis has really made its impact on industry, especially at medium and small-sized factories, we've seen workers have to struggle with more intense production requirements. Factories are trying to squeeze as much as they can out of workers while they're working, so pressure is up. I mean, we can say that the reform and opening has created more wealth in China, but I think it's very important to remember that that wealth is not very evenly distributed.
Around the world, women make up a majority of the lowest paid workers in the workforce. Are there any women in your organization or who are working with your organization? And are there any programs that you have that focus specifically on women workers?
Our office in China, so CLW in New York is a very small organization. It's actually just myself, the executive director, and a number of volunteers. Most of our staff is actually in China. When I started at the organization earlier this year, I spent a month at the office in China, and at that time, the office was all 100% staffed by women. Currently, the office has one woman out of five total workers. In general, this is something that I went to ask the executive director about himself, because he has a very wide network of contacts within this labor movement. And in general, he said that about 20 or 30% of labor activists who are part of this labor movement in China are women, which is interesting because the majority of workers who are working in the factories, you know, the people that this labor movement is working to help, are actually women. So in terms of, even in terms of the work that CLW is doing, in terms of the training that we're doing, in terms of the legal advising that we're doing in our office and via our office hotline in Shenzhen, the beneficiaries of most of that work are actually women, because women workers do make up the majority of the workforce, but they are a minority in the labor movement.
And do you feel that at this point that your work, China Labor Watch, that your work is having an impact on human rights in China, labor rights?
Absolutely. I hesitate to say it's China Labor Watch that is at the front of any kind of labor movement. China Labor Watch is a very interesting organization, because basically we are the American arm of an organization that operates mostly in China. Li Cheng is a Chinese person. He came to the U.S. in the year 2000, but is essentially doing the same work he was doing before 2000 when he was in China. And Li Cheng is connected not only to our office in China, but to a number of other labor organizations in China. And I think that this network of organizations, this growing number of civil society organizations, is doing very important work and is making a difference in terms of educating workers about their rights and giving workers resources to advocate for their own rights.
Well, thank you very much, Greg, for being with us. How can people get more information about China Labor Watch and the issues it deals with?
The best way to get more information on CLW is to visit our website, and that website is www.chinalaborwatch.org. That's spelled CHINALABORWATCH. I give the spelling because, you know, sometimes labor has a U. And on our website, there are resources. You have access to our current campaigns. I've mentioned Walmart and Disney throughout this interview, because currently CLW has been doing a number of investigations within their supply chain. There's also links to other organizations that are working on similar issues. And also, you can get on our mailing list via our website. And we would be happy to send updates right to the email boxes of anyone interested in learning more about what CLW is doing.
Many thanks to Gregory Fay, Program Director for China Labor Watch. For more information, visit the site China Labor Watch. That's all one word. ChinaLaborWatch.org. Our second guest for this Black Friday special shoppers edition of Voices is Bjorn Clausen, PhD. Bjorn Clausen is the executive director of Sweat Free Communities and was the lead organizer for the Bangor Clean Clothes campaign, a national model for community-based anti-sweatshop activism from 1996 to 2005. Under Mr. Clausen's leadership, the campaign was a founding member of Sweat Free Communities. Mr. Clausen received the Maine Initiative's Social Landscape Artist Award 2006 and the Dirigo Social Movement Leader Award in 2004. Bjorn, welcome to WERU.
Thank you.
Okay, first, summarize for us the history of the Bangor Clean Clothes campaign and its relationship with sweat-free communities. And also, could you tell us if your focus is on the clothing industry or does it extend to other consumer products such as housewares?
Well, thank you again for having me on this program. The Bangor Clean Clothes campaign was a program of a group in Bangor called PICA, Peace Through Inter-American Community Action, which many of your listeners are probably familiar with. So PICA was a Central America solidarity organization and started out to address, to turn its focus from ending the wars in Central America to focusing directly on issues of economic justice, and were looking for ways in which they could involve people in the local community to fight for global economic justice and economic justice in Central America, and hit upon this idea, the Bangor Clean Clothes Campaign. The idea was basically that, you know, that the clothes that are sold in our local stores should be made in decent working conditions. And we had a leverage here because we're consumers, we have power, the local stores have power, we can all come together and demand of the brands, the major apparel brands that supply our community, that their products need to be made in decent working conditions. So that was the first phase of the Clean Clothes Campaign, working directly with local retailers to ensure that our purchasing dollars actually go to factories around the world that where workers have decent working conditions and where they're paid decent wages and where they don't slave in sweatshop environments. The second phase of the campaign was turned to our institutional purchasing power as our local city, the city of Bangor, the state of Maine. It turns out that our local government agencies are mega consumers as well, and consumers of apparel products, police uniforms, fire department uniforms, parks and recreation products. These, you know, this particular city of Bangor had really supported the Bangor Clean Clothes Campaign and said, look, our local stores here should be selling products that are made in decent working conditions. It was quite logical for them then, there was a grassroots campaign that persuaded them to do so, to say, well, the purchases that we do with taxpayers' dollars when we buy police uniforms, et cetera, we should also make sure that those purchases go to factories that are compliant with basic labor standards. And so the city of Bangor became one of the first cities in the country to actually adopt what we call now a sweatshop-free purchasing ordinance. And the state of Maine actually became the first state in the nation to adopt such a law back in 2001. At that point, we were already familiar with similar campaigns around the country that had sprung up kind of on their own independently, just like our campaign had done. You know, there were campaigns in the state of Washington, state of Wisconsin, in New York, and we founded Sweat-Free Communities, this was back in 2003, basically as a network of those local campaigns, similar to the Bangor Clean Clothes Campaign, so that we all could share experiences, share knowledge, build a cohesive, powerful national movement.
And is your focus strictly on the clothing industry?
It remains on the clothing industry. Focus remains on the clothing industry, yes, for a variety of reasons. One is, because the abuses in this global apparel industry are still prevalent. Violations of basic human rights, basic labor rights is still the norm in these factories around the world. And it also remains our focus because we know we have a lot of knowledge about the industry at this point, and we know what it takes to improve working conditions. However, there are a number of campaigns around the country and also cities around the country that have directed their sweat-free purchasing ordinances to products other than apparel. Some are comprehensive in scope, saying everything that the city buys should be made in decent working conditions. Some have started focusing, looking at particularly at the electronics industry as well.
Sweat-free communities like China Labor Watch, whom we just talked to, works directly with workers and worker organizations, and also works with those who purchase products, including the schools and institutions and organizations you just mentioned, and also consumers. Tell us about your work with consumers.
With individual consumers?
Individuals, people who in the community who are buying products for their families.
Right. Well, I mean, our main work is so we are a national network of local campaigns, and the campaigns are basically in communities. And the campaigns try to persuade their cities, their counties, their state governments to go sweat-free, basically. So we really are, our primary purpose is in supporting local activism and strengthening local activism, providing educational support, providing technical support, and sometimes when we can swing it, even financial support for local campaigns. We do provide guides for individual shoppers who want to make sure that their product, when they do their shopping, when we do our shopping, we also can support, the decent workplaces around the world. So we do have, every year at this time, when people are more focused on holiday shopping than normally, we come out with the Shop with a Conscience Consumer Guide. And the companies that qualify for that, and they actually need to go through a pretty rigorous application to qualify for this consumer guide. There are three main criteria to qualify. One is transparency. In other words, they need to tell us exactly where the products that they want to sell us are made, the location of the factories and the addresses, the names. And they also need to answer some fairly detailed questions about working conditions. But most importantly, all the products that we feature in the consumer guide are made by workers who are organized. They're organized into independent democratic unions or in cooperatives such that they have an effective voice to determine their own wages and working conditions. Their voice needs to be respected in the workplace. And we can all, there are actually some really, really great options in this consumer guide. And if I may do some shameless advertising here for our local business in this consumer guide, Justice Clothing has always been part of the consumer guide from the very start. They're located here in Bangor. You can go to justiceclothing.com. They do an awful lot of work, hard work, to identify, in their case, they're all union-made clothing options for us.
Are they all USA-made?
Yeah, they're all U.S. For Justice Clothing, they're all U.S. or Canadian made. So, and that's also deliberate because they don't, they're also environmentally sensitive here. They don't want our clothing to be traveled halfway around the globe.
We just have a couple of minutes left. Tell us about the Shopper's Guide, what it offers to folks.
Sure. It's an internet-based guide. So you go to sweatfree.org. Sweatfree.org. There's a link from our homepage to the Shopper's Guide. You can see a number of different stores, internet-based stores like Justice Clothing, and it offers absolutely anything you want in the way of apparel. There's also a few PDF brochures that you can download and print out. It's basically links. Then, if you go on the website, there's links to the stores, and we encourage everybody to use it. Of course, another reason that we have the Shopper's Guide up there, as I said, is because we want to stimulate local activism, is to get people to think about what they purchase and how they can get active in their local communities. And we certainly, if people are interested in being active, to ensure that their consumer dollars and their taxpayer dollars are go to workplaces that employ workers in decent working conditions, we encourage you to contact us as well. And their contact information is sweatfree.org, or you can send an email to info@sweatfree.org.
Well, Bjorn Clausen, Executive Director of Sweatfree Communities, thank you for joining us. Listeners, be sure to visit the website sweatfree.org. There you will find lots of information, including the Shop with a Conscience Consumer Guide. You've been listening to a special edition of Voices on WERU-FM Community Radio. This is Marge May reporting.